Minainain Baranin, Malta through international eyes. Yet another episode in this long-running series on Campus 103.7. It's broadcast in English most of the time, unless there's a foreign person who I interview on this program who has learnt Maltese, and then it's a special occasion and we talk in Maltese. But most of the episodes are in English because they have an international audience. People all over the world listen to this program. It's all about foreign people who have chosen to make Malta their home, or Maltese people who have a big connection with another country, with perhaps they live abroad but occasionally visit Malta, and thus we can get their perspective on how they've seen Malta change, and also about the other countries that they live or have lived in. And in fact, today's guest, and he has brought along some offspring as well, which is the more the merrier. That's great. Today's guest is a Maltese man who has been living abroad for half his life, pretty much, since he left university, this very university here in Malta. And he's lived in the United Kingdom and is now living in the Netherlands. It is a great pleasure for me to welcome to the studio Professor Mauro Overend. Welcome.
Pleasure to be here, Conan. Nice to see you.
And his son, Ian. Hello, Ian.
Hello, hello.
And Anna, daughter.
Hi.
Hi there. Welcome to the show. I'll be picking your brains, Ian and Anna, later on about your perspective of where you live, Holland, and of Malta. And were you born here, or you weren't even born in Malta?
No.
So you have Maltese blood. But Malta's pretty much a foreign country to you. So that will be an interesting perspective. Ian is half and half. I don't know. Were you born in Malta?
I was born in Nottingham, in the UK.
In the UK. There you go.
Both parents from Malta. So
there you go. Yeah. So both your parents are Maltese. And yet, you know, your perspective on life is heavily influenced by the UK and the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Mauro and I were at school together when we were quite young, right up to university, we were still in regular contact. We now stay in touch thanks to WhatsApp especially, right?
Yes, yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah, very much, yeah.
Some nice memories of attending il liceo in Hamrun together. Mauro, I said you're a professor. You're a professor of what?
I'm a professor of structural design and mechanics, which is about the buildings and how to design buildings in an efficient and safe way. So lots of new materials, different materials, different structures, different, you know, multi-story buildings, long span buildings.
You're quite a specialist in glass, I believe, right?
Yes, that's where my interest in research started. So I thought glass was quite fascinating because I knew a lot about other materials, right? Like like steel and concrete and stone, right? These are materials we are used to.
Yes.
But glass is something we see around us and use all the time, mm-hmm. but it's a bit of a mysterious material, right? Yes. What are its properties? Why is it transparent? You know, how strong is it? Why is it fragile?
Mm.
So I became interested in this intriguing material.
I don't want to embarrass you or anything, but it must be said that you're one of the world's leading authorities now on construction with glass, I believe.
That's very kind of you. I'm not very easily embarrassed, but thank you. I suppose you could say that, yes. And yeah, so there are often issues with, shall we say, issues with buildings around the world, mm. which are trying to push the boundaries of what is possible with glass.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are successfully
overcome,
and some not. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I get a call from some unusual part of the world saying, we have a problem, can you help?
Wow.
So I suppose that's, that keeps it interesting.
And this is one of the things I like to celebrate as well in this series, Malta Through International Eyes. Minainain Baranin is how you find it online on our website. That's the Maltese name. But our Maltese human resource experts, so many experts in various fields who have done so well around the world, in the medical field and in your case in engineering/architecture, which is amazing. So we're very proud of you. Let's go back to your childhood in Malta, playing football. In those days, you could still almost play on the streets in the 80s.
Very much so.
But there were plenty of places to play five-a-side football. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, right up to the point when you left Malta to study, continue your studies abroad.
I'd call it idyllic, right? I think it was that time where, as you say, right, you could play football on the street. You could just go off for a hike somewhere and a bunch of friends and explore an area. But I have lots of memories of playing football, as you rightly put it.
Mauro's quite good at football. Well, you represented our school one at a few times.
I think I was a better way of putting it. But it was fantastic to get together and play in all sorts of places. We had different kind of areas, right? We used to play sometimes in Baltzan and sometimes in Lía and sometimes in Manuel Island.
At Manuel Island, yes.
Sometimes here at university in the
there was an area that was a five-a-side, a semi-five-a-side pitch that has now been built up. Yes, absolutely. And you were always the instigator. And in those days, we'd use all shapes. They would always be spherical, but they'd all sizes of balls, whether it was an oval football or a tiny tennis ball.
Correct.
As long as we played football.
As long as we played football. Absolutely. including in even extremely short breaks that sometimes we had in between lessons, right?
Yeah.
You had a 15-minute break, and that was an excuse to play a 15-minute football match. And so that was always a...
Indeed.
Yeah, I have very, very, very fond memories of that. Yeah.
Indeed. And you grew up in Capara, San Juan area, I believe?
Yeah, I first lived in Emcida when I was a little child, until I was about 12 or 13.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved to Capara. So always within... Bizarrely, always within a stone throw's of the university.
Indeed.
I don't know why.
Well, it was your destiny.
Yeah, yeah.
Your first school was...
Stella Maris College
was it did.
Yeah, and then primary. And then I moved to the secondary school to the junior lyceum in Hamroom.
Did you have one of those experiences from Stella Maris, which always produced good footballers and good sports people? Did you have an experience in Sweden?
That's right. Yes, there was this really there was a culture of sport and football in particular, and every year there was the
Gothia Cup.
The Gothia Cup. Called? That's right.
I know so many people who.
And the team was called Stelmar.
Mm.
And the Stelmar team used to be selected from among the year six, right? The grade six children.
Approximately age 11-ish.
Age 11, 12, mm-hmm. That's right. And about 15 or 18 of those children used to go off to this international competition called the Gothia Cup.
Indeed. Did you do well?
We did. I think, if I remember correctly, we did pretty well. I think we went all the way up to the semifinals or something of that level anyway. And there was even, it was done so professionally, there was even a training camp before the competition in Sweden, in what was then Yugoslavia.
Oh.
So we went off to a training camp where we had a couple of weeks of intensive training in the run-up to the competition, which was then in Gothenburg, in Sweden. So again, very fond memories of that time.
And this was the 80s when people traveled more than they did before that, but not as much as they do nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
it was a fantastic experience.
Yes.
It was really nice.
And then you decided to choose architecture as your higher education, sixth form and university.
That's right. I was always fascinated by the sciences and mathematics in particular.
Mm.
But I wasn't too keen on remaining rather abstract and theoretical. Mm-hmm. So what could I do that involved some level of mathematics, some creativity, and you actually get to build something in the process?
Mm.
So it had to be either architecture or mechanical engineering or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought architecture was the more fascinating, perhaps, of the two. And also I was somewhat inspired by my uncle who was an architect.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember going with him to visit some...
Oh,
building sites,
construction sites.
Some construction sites, and that was fascinating.
Yes.
That you'd see one, one week you'd see pretty much an open site with nothing on it.
Yes.
And you turn up 6 months later and there's this sort of impressive building, which is...
of course, that would be inspirational, yeah. Wouldn't it? Speaking of your uncle, Mauro Overend, your uncle actually was responsible or partly responsible for some quite iconic buildings, I believe. Maybe we can give them a mention. Wasn't he the man who designed the old Axis discotheque?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Which I remember you being quite proud of.
I was quite proud of, and I remember him joking that he was off to, before he went off to work, he said he was going to the discotheque.
Yes,
But of course, it was still under construction, so that was a bit different than going to the disco. He was also responsible, or one of the two or three architects responsible for the hospital, the Mater Dei Hospital.
Oh gosh! So what's his name?
Mario Grech.
Okay.
Not the cardinal.
Absolutely. But yes, so great inspiration.
Yeah.
And also just to give a little taste of the 80s as well in Malta, for those listening, maybe international people, and also people who remember the era. Because I was in your class as well, and I studied graphical communication, we called it, or what it used to be called technical drawing. And we were in that phase where it was switching over from using the old T-squares made of wood, which a lot of people from the 70s would remember, to buying a brand new sort of very technical-looking plastic design
drawing board,
for even our teachers were a little bit unfamiliar with them, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. So this, for the benefit of the younger listeners, this was in the analog days, the pre-digital, because of course nowadays all drawings are made on computer.
You mean even at a young age they start
studying. They do some hand sketching. But now in for example the faculty where I teach in Delft in the Netherlands.
Yes.
All drawing boards have long been replaced by essentially desks, horizontal desks now.
Yes.
The big drawing boards normally are on a slope, right? On a slant.
Indeed.
Big kind of open plan spaces where students can open their laptops and work on digital drawings now.
Wow.
But you rightly say there was technological advances even in the analog stage, right? So you went from this old-fashioned wooden kind of drawing board setup to something that was a little bit more futuristic at the time, where you had this kind of, as you say, plastic kind of drawing board
You can stick your paper down
without using tape.
Precisely. Amazing stuff.
Precisely.
Such memories now. It's all flooding back to me now. So you came to university here in Malta. And you graduated from as an architect.
Architecture and civil engineering, that's right.
There
from
we go.
The faculty of what is now called the built environment,
mm-hmm.
but architecture and civil engineering.
Did you study under anyone, any notable people? That
oh, yes, yeah, mentioned? Absolutely. I mean, I had some very inspirational teachers and lecturers. I was always interested, well, I liked architecture generally, but I was always interested in structural aspects, yeah. So the strengths of materials and the how to design load bearing kind of frameworks and large structures, and there we had I had three very inspirational lectures. One of them was Alex Torpiano, and the other one was Dion Bohajar, and the other one is Mark Bonello.
Mm-hmm.
I believe both Alex and Dion are now retired or semi-retired.
Mm-hmm.
That's how old we are, I'm afraid, Colin.
Well, we're getting there.
and Mark Bonello is now dean of the faculty, so he's still very, very active. Yeah.
Well, maybe you can pop over and say hello.
I absolutely should. Yeah.
if he's working today.
I'm actually still in touch with them, and I was also I met him last time round. So maybe I should pop over.
Well, they must be very proud of you as well that you've gone on over the years. One thing I like to boast with my friends, like, my friend Mauro, who I was at school with, ended up being a lecturer at Cambridge University. And I know that you were at Cambridge for quite a few years, and then you moved to Delft. And to me, that's a step down. But obviously, it must have been a step up because you wouldn't have made... I think you know what you're doing in your career. But obviously, Cambridge is better known in general than Delft University in Holland. But nevertheless, probably in your specialization, it made sense for you, since you were headhunted, to go there.
Pretty much. I think in order not to upset anyone, let's just call it a sideways step rather than a step up or a step down.
Very good.
But yeah, very much so. Of course, Cambridge is a a fantastic history, right? This is one of the most prestigious universities, and it's been around for 800 years, actually more than 800 years. Delft, of course, is a younger university. It's been around for about 150 years. Mm-hmm. But universities are also ranked in terms of their subject areas.
I see.
So they are ranked as a whole, but also in terms of their subjects. And then
some universities are better known for their medical school, for example,
or their school of economics, or their school of engineering, right?
Indeed.
And Delft has a fantastic reputation in terms of its engineering, and in particular its civil engineering and architecture. Also very good in mechanical engineering, and also really good in other engineering subjects, right? Like materials science and things like this.
I want to get the kids involved. Anna, for example, do you understand what your father does for a living, or his job?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's explained it to me quite a few times. So, yeah.
Yeah. How old are you, Anna?
I'm 11.
And you attend school in the Netherlands?
Yeah.
Do you attend a particular, like an international school?
Yeah, I go to the International School of The Hague.
I see. And so what languages do you learn? Are you taught?
We learn Dutch and
English.
We speak in English.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we move into secondary, we can choose French, Spanish or German.
I see. Do you learn a little bit of Maltese at home from your Maltese parents, perhaps?
Yeah, I don't speak at all, but I can understand
Some bit. Ian, you have experience of living in the UK.
Yeah.
In fact, you were born there.
Mm-hmm. Nottingham, as soon as I was born, I think, for 6 months. I don't really recall much of that. And then, Cambridge, I lived for, I think, 11, 12 years. Mm. So that was a major part of where I lived in the UK.
Yes. Yeah. And then when you moved to Holland, when the family moved to Holland, was it tough for you? Was it hard to get
I don't think it was that difficult, because I moved at a decently young age, so I was able to make friends quite easily, because no one had really closed themselves off into you know, friend groups at that time.
So I mean, we're talking, you were about 12?
Yeah, exactly, 12. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of making friends, it was fine. It was great. It was good. I mean, there's other aspects as well. Weather, it's pretty much exactly the same, apart from the fact that the Netherlands has a lot more wind. So that wasn't too difficult. It wasn't a crazy climate adjustment. I mean, the way of living, I think the Netherlands has an amazing cycling culture, which I've really adapted to nicely now. Oh. I think it's amazing. You can get anywhere, anywhere you want with just a bike, which is something that I don't think I can say for the UK. So I really like that. Mm. But in terms of an overall change, I think it was a fairly easy changeover. Yeah.
Do you see yourself following in your father's footsteps, or are you interested in a different subject?
Not exactly. I would say somewhat similar, because I just graduated from high school now last month, and I'm going to university next year. I'm going to the University of Leiden to do data science and artificial intelligence. So it's still under the STEM sort of umbrella, but not the exact same as.
Wow, but AI, incredible. Yeah. And you had to learn Dutch along the way, I suppose.
Was
that tough?
I thought it was going to be impossible when I moved here, because I heard the language and it sounds absolutely horrible. But I think it wasn't awful, because I played in a Dutch-speaking football club for many years.
Oh.
And I think living in the country, hearing people speak Dutch all the time made it a lot easier to learn. So now I think I can say that I have a fairly good level of Dutch.
And so, like, at the high school, was it the same high school that Anna mentioned?
Yeah,
international?
It's on the same campus.
But at university now, they're going to be speaking Dutch mainly, I guess.
No, right? my course is in English.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, okay. That's good.
Very good.
Yeah.
And Maltese, have you managed to pick up any?
Maltese, I mean, I think I can understand everything. My speaking is of a minimal level, let's say. And reading is all right, and writing is non-existent. So,
Anna, what do you want to do when you grow up?
I think I want to do something with, like, designing and buildings and stuff like that.
Ah, the influence is there. Well, best of luck. The kids, we spoke about them picking up Maltese. Did you and your lovely wife, Natalie, did you make it a point to teach them Maltese? Did you do it in a formal way? Did you find some app to help them along? Or do you just speak to each other in Maltese and the kids pick it up as they go along?
I think it's mostly the latter, rather than by design. For some reason, Natalie, my wife, and I, we speak to each other in Maltese. We find it very difficult to speak to each other in any other language.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless whether we're in the UK or we're in the Netherlands, we just speak to each other in Maltese.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we speak to the children in more in English than in Maltese.
Mm-hmm.
I think Natalie speaks to them more in Maltese than I do. But therefore, they kind of pick up on this kind of conversation. We're having one conversation in English, the other in Maltese, right?
Yes.
So there's this kind of
switching
from one language to another. So we've not done any formal education.
Sit down, sort of give them books.
I mean, of course, they have books and they've got some books in Maltese, of course, and things of that sort. But not in a formal kind of instruction lesson type of way.
Maltese is a foreign language or anything. And they seem, Ian and Anna are saying that they understand most of what they hear in Maltese.
To the extent that when my wife and I need to say something which is private but in front of them, we have to switch to Italian because Italian is a language they do not understand,
of course,
and of course then they speak to each other in Dutch, which makes me a bit nervous because my level of Dutch is rather poor, so then I am at a loss when they speak.
Yes,
the children speak to each other in Dutch.
We'll come back to Italian in a second because that's another interesting point about Malta and development over the years. But you and Natalie have not learned Dutch as well as the kids have, for example?
Nowhere near as well as the kids have, because of course the kids have had formal kind of instruction and in their schools, right? And exams and tests and things of the sort. Natalie has done more of an effort than I have. So she is far more... She's able to pick up most conversations. Speaking is a bit rusty, but she's able to kind of communicate in a basic way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I've done very little, because everything I teach and I write and I do at the University of Delft, at TU Delft, is in English.
I see.
And there are, of course, courses in Dutch, but I don't teach those.
Mm-hmm.
And the community there at TU Delft is very international. There's a handful of Dutch colleagues, but colleagues are coming from all over. And of course, the international language of science and technology is English.
Indeed.
So everyone speaks English. Yeah.
And you can get by in English even if you go to the shops or whatever in Holland, right?
In
the Netherlands.
Very much so. Even if you're on a bus and you try to tell the driver, I want to get to the stop, the bus driver will pick up that you're not Dutch.
Yes.
And switch to English.
Instantly. So they're very generous as well.
Which is nice and generous, but on the hand, there's not a big incentive to learn the language because
there is that aspect. To go back to Italian, yes, we come from that generation, probably the last but one generation that knew Italian almost as well as English, sometimes better than English or Maltese, because we'd watch so much television in Italian. But by the time we got to 16-17, cable television came into Malta and people started watching more American and British channels. But we were the last generation, I think, that kind of picked up Italian from television.
I think so. I think there's more choice, of course, now, right? Whereas before, if you were, for example, if you are interested in football, well, it's Malta, right? So most people are either following, apart from the local football, of course, but it was either some Italian football
or
the British, the English football. But of course, you used to get a lot more coverage of Italian football because you used to get the Italian kind of stations, right?
Indeed,
TV stations,
radio
even, right?
But
you wouldn't get that much exposure to English football, because you didn't get the British stations,
indeed,
right?
Yeah. If we weren't out on a Sunday afternoon, if we were at home maybe doing homework or whatever, we'd have the Rai radio, because they wouldn't be live on TV at the time, and the rights were different, weren't they? So we'd be listening to the commentaries from the various stadia in Italy with the various legendary Italian presenters, the Sandro Ciottis of those days, used to do an impression of him, I remember. And then in the evening at 6 o'clock, there'd be all the goals would be shown on Italian television. It was a different world.
Yes, I think that the Sunday schedule was pretty much set, right? There was this time where you would hear the live football on radio, and then followed by 6 or 6:30, I can't remember, around that time, the highlights on TV, right?
But if you were a total and utter Italian football fanatic, then you'd watch La Domenica Sportiva at 10 o'clock at night on TV as well. Oh, the memories. So that's it. You're Mauro Overend. Overend is not a Maltese surname.
It's not, no. No,
so
it's, what's the story with that?
The ancestor is there. Yes.
The ancestry is as far back as it's been traced, and not by me, actually by one of my uncles, it's somewhere our at least kind of branch of the Overend family, which is not very popular anyway, is coming from Northern Ireland.
Mm.
So there's some to the extent that when I was in Cambridge, one of my colleagues
yes,
a lecturer colleagues, was from Northern Ireland.
I see.
I said, "Oh, you Roverend." He said, "I had four or five mates in my class who are Overend. Are you related to them?" So there's a unscientific proof that it's popular in Ireland.
Indeed.
But apparently it was first recorded somewhere in Yorkshire. But so it's somewhere from...
Somewhere from the British Isles, Ireland.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Although I've been in the Netherlands several times and people say, "Oh, this sounds like quite a Flemish surname, Overend."
Interesting.
So it's somewhere there, yes. Somewhere in that region of the world. Yeah.
And we mentioned the sports commentators. This time, BBC, World Service, there was a football commentator on Saturday afternoons, because you'd be able, pre-internet, listen on shortwave to the BBC World Service, and they'd have their... Because English football was on Saturdays, Italian football was on Sundays. There was a commentator or a journalist, sports journalist, whose surname was Overend.
No, I think it's Jonathan, right?
Yes, Jonathan Overend, that's right.
Yeah, yeah. I never had the pleasure of meeting him, but I did actually get to hear him a few times, and even when we were in the UK, he was still active on radio. Yeah.
So there's that sort of somewhere in your ancestry, there's Northern Irish, perhaps British roots, your Maltese, yeah, exposed to Italian on television, including Japanese cartoons dubbed into Italian. Then you go off to live in the UK, and now you're living in Holland. So that's quite a mix.
And in that mix, my grandmother was Italian too. That explains my name, which is more of,
Mauro,
of an Italian.
Of course, indeed. So quite an interesting mix there. I'm speaking to Professor Mauro Overend, who is Maltese but has lived more than half his life in other countries, including the UK and the Netherlands. He's based in the Netherlands now. He's a lecturer at the University of Delft. What is your title? Is it lecturer?
It's
or
a professor.
Professor?
Yes.
Wow,
but people call me Mauro, so it's absolutely fine.
Okay. Did you have to wear the gowns and the mortarboard at Cambridge, and sort of speak with a certain accent and beat the students with a cane when you were at Cambridge?
everything, all of the above, except from the beating, of course. but it's very... the colleges in particular in Cambridge are very kind of Harry Potter-like. So even if you dine in college in the evenings,
yes,
and there's a dinner every evening if you want to, of course I never went every evening, you have to wear the gown for the dinner, and you would also have to say grace in Latin before the dinner.
Oh, wow.
And then after dinner, thank you kind of prayer, also in Latin.
Gosh. So tradition is still hugely important.
Yeah. In the colleges, yes. In the departments, which is the university is made up of colleges and departments, and typically lecturers, professors are members of both. So you have affiliated with the college, but you mostly work in your department.
Which college were you?
Christ's College.
Very famous.
Which is the college of John Milton and Charles Darwin.
Gosh.
And so it's quite a few famous names there.
Amazing.
But it is very that's still rooted, which is nice. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, when you go to the department, you've got modern labs, right, with modern equipment, technology, right, and this was the Department of Engineering, so it was quite
advanced.
But there's still a lot of I miss some of those traditions.
Really?
In Delft, yes.
University of Delft is more sort of modern.
It's more like the departments, yes. Mm. There are no colleges there.
You were also a big fan of Milan, the AC Milan football team in the time when famous players as well, they had the trio of Dutch players. It's amusing how you ended up in the Netherlands when, like, your idol was Ruud Gullit, wasn't he?
Yes, it was Ruud Gullit and Marco van Basten Frank Rijkaard.
Indeed.
And of course, there were some very amazing Italian players too, like Franco Baresi and
Ancelotti,
Paolo
Maldini
Carlo Ancelotti.
That was a super
team.
This
is the super team,
of the late 80s.
With Arrigo Sacchi as the coach. So this was quite a kind of a revolution in how football was played in Italy at the time.
Indeed. And they won all the cups that could be won at the time. That's right. You were a member of the local supporters club as well, I believe.
I was not very heavily involved, but I was a member. And some people don't believe it, but I don't blame them. Some people say, "Oh, you sided with AC Milan because they started winning trophies." But of course, I started liking Milan before they were winning trophies.
Yes. Yeah. But yes, to be fair to most people in Malta who follow football, we'd say like 80% are divided into either those who like English football, and a substantial amount of them are either Man United or Liverpool supporters. There are other supporters of Arsenal and other teams, but let's say Man United and Liverpool, massive followings. And then for Italian football, Juventus has a massive following in Malta. And then there's Milan, there's Inter, and some of the other teams. But you were in the Milan camp.
That's right. Yes, yeah, the Milan camp. Yeah, Milan, I think, is the way. Yeah, but of course, then when we moved to the UK, I got a quite a heavy kind of dose of kind of Premier League kind of.
Of course.
Because we were based in the UK for 18 years.
Yes.
There you would get the, you know, match of the day. You know, the whole kind of BBC and
so you were exposed to a lot of English
football.
Do you have an English team that?
Not in particular. I think my son is probably more kind of Premier League oriented than I am, because he spent most of his childhood there.
Ian, who do you support?
Yeah, I support Chelsea.
Chelsea.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And do you play? Do you still play? You said you played.
Well, I played with the a club in the Netherlands up until I was about 16, and then I stopped to focus on school, but I was still playing with the school team, which was slightly less competitive, and it was more just for fun and, you know, play with my friends. So yeah.
As a footballer who has Maltese roots, perhaps sometimes it would come up with your football mates, especially the Dutch ones, and Malta and Holland have a bit of there's a bit of history. Going back to the early 80s, and in fact, whenever Holland play against Malta, they always try and score as many goals as possible.
Yep. Yeah.
It's like a mission that they have. We actually played against them a few months ago,
yeah,
and they beat us 8-0.
Yeah.
Obviously, Malta is one of the smallest football nations in the world. Holland is one of the powerhouses. But they try extra hard because they think, or they say, that way back in the early 80s, we lost against Spain on purpose, basically, so that they wouldn't go to the whole World Cup, blah, blah, blah. Did that ever come up? Did you ever get teased for being Maltese as a football player?
No, I don't think so. And it's also because I think initially when I joined the club, I had a very heavy British accent, so they kind of just assumed that I was fully British, and it never really came up that the Maltese roots were apparent.
I see. So obviously you got your accent from being born and brought up in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, how many times have you actually been to Malta over the years to visit? Once a year, maybe?
Once or twice a year, every year, I think, since I've been born. So quite a large number of times, yeah.
I'm coming to you shortly, Anna. I'm going to be asking you similar questions. But how do you feel about Malta? What is Malta to you, Ian?
I really love it. I really like coming here, especially during summer. Obviously, the entire family's here, so it's lovely to see them once or twice a year. And I just think it's great. I love the sea. I think the sea here is amazing. And yeah, just the Mediterranean culture, the food, just everything about it I really like.
But would you see yourself living here, or given the choice, you'd continue living perhaps in the Netherlands?
Yeah, you know, never say never, but I mean, I think the Netherlands is a great place. So I'll be staying in the Netherlands for the next 3 years at least, until I complete university, and then I can see what my options are from there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when it does come up that you have some Maltese roots, that you have Maltese parents, what is the most common thing that your friends or your new friends ask you about Malta? I mean, does the average person know that Malta exists?
I think from the school that I was in the Netherlands, quite a lot of people know, because it's an international community. It's they're not all just from one area or one place, so everyone kind of knew about Malta already. They were just, you know, a bit, I'm not sure how to put this, but like kind of in shock to meet a Maltese person, because there's so few of them.
That's okay, I understand. Yeah. Yes, how interesting.
Mm.
How about you, Anna? First of all, do you play any sports? Do you have any extra curricular activities?
Yes, I do swimming, diploma swimming and hockey.
Are you going to be representing any country soon, Malta or maybe even the Netherlands?
Probably not. I'm not like, I don't really want to become a star. I just want to put some teamwork into my life.
Oh, that's a great attitude. Does it ever come up with your friends that you are from Malta or that you have a connection with Malta?
I think now Malta's becoming a bit more popular, so more of my friends know what it is. But they're kind of just, when I say I'm part Maltese, they're kind of like shocked because I don't really have any kind of accent or anything that like kind of represents that I'm Maltese.
So where do they think you're from?
They think I'm from the UK.
You speak good English.
I speak really good English compared to many people in my class.
I see. And your visits to Malta, how do you feel about them? How do you feel about coming here?
I really like it. Compared to the food in the Netherlands, it's so good.
Really?
Yeah.
Probably all the relatives making a fuss of you and giving you huge portions. So what don't you like about food, like the food in the Netherlands?
For example, like their sausage. Yeah. I don't know what they do with it, but it's just really bad in my opinion.
Okay, fair enough. And what's your favorite food here in Malta?
Probably pastizzi.
Oh, nice. You can't have too many of those, but yeah, absolutely. Pastizzi, fantastic.
I think it's fair to say that we didn't move to the Netherlands for its food or for its weather.
Okay.
I think that's
okay.
a fair...
Does it rain a lot?
It rains a lot,
okay.
Especially winter.
Okay.
And it's very windy. And we refer to it as... And very often it does the two at the same time. So it's horizontal rain, essentially, is what you get.
Of course. Indeed. Yeah. And Anna, do you enjoy the sea here in Malta?
Yeah, it's...
Of course, you're a swimmer.
It's very nice. Just compared to the sea in the Netherlands, it's so, like, clear. And the underwater sea life is really nice.
Fantastic. You do a lot of snorkeling then.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, excellent. Mauro, back to you. So where did you finish your studies and graduate?
Well, I, as you rightly put it, when I did my bachelor's degree here in Malta in Architecture Civil Engineering.
Yes.
And then I went to the UK to do an MSc, a Master of Science at that time in Structural Engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went on to do a PhD. Also the same university. And this was
the
University of Surrey in the UK, which is not very well known. But I went there because I was fascinated by these very long span structures, normally referred to as space frames or space grid structures, these very long kind of large.
Yeah, what
over gymnasia or these very large
cover over Wembley Stadium.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those kind of things. Yeah. And I was fascinated by that. And there at the time there was this world famous research group known as the Space Structures Research Center. Nothing to do with outer space, but space being a space. Yeah. And I went there and I ended up in the end doing a PhD on glass, not on space frames, but still it was a very dynamic group because they were kind of involved in research and design of space frames in India, in the US, right, in South America. So it was again a very international kind of a setting for a research group.
Yeah. Earlier in the program, towards the beginning, I mentioned how you're considered one of the world's leading authorities in your field. Please don't blush. We do need to mention some of your achievements. I know that you've designed or built that bridge that you were given an award, an international award for.
Yeah,
don't feel shy, please. Let's tell the world this humble Maltese guy from originally from Emcida and then San Juan and now king of the glass world.
that bridge was actually a young engineer's design competition. So it wasn't actually one that eventually got built, but it was an international design competition that. I entered with a Maltese colleague of mine, and it was the setting was this industrial land area called Ironbridge, so in Shropshire in the UK, and what is known as the Black Country, which is where the kind of a lot of the Industrial Revolution started, and there is this very famous iron bridge, one of the, I think it's the first iron bridge
Probably from the time of Brunel.
From the time from before Brunel, but from the industrial early days of the Industrial Revolution.
Yes.
Over the River Severn, and there was this competition to build a pedestrian bridge.
Yes.
Next to it, just a few meters upstream of it, in connection with a visitor center that was being built.
Yes.
We had this brilliant idea of actually why not a bridge made entirely of glass?
Gosh.
So we tried to push the limits of what was possible.
Yeah.
And it ended up getting an award, and I remember at the time.
Quite a respected award.
Yeah, it was from the Institution of Structural Engineers, which is the UK Association of Building Engineers and Structural Engineers.
Yes.
It was really good to be in the mix with there were a few awards.
High
there
flyers,
were three main awards. Yeah, there were a few big companies who got there were the Fosters and the Bureau Happolds, right? These are big very well known companies in the UK. And among them were a couple of Maltese engineer architects.
Yes.
which is very nice too.
Indeed. Indeed. Do you keep any relationship? You said you're still in touch with your ex-master here. Do you keep a relationship with the University of Malta?
Yeah, I do. There's actually, I'm in not as much as I would like, and that's more of a time kind of constraint than anything else. But I also help supervise or advise on a PhD project with another professor here called Vince Bohajar. And Etienne Magris is doing a PhD on, no prizes for guessing. He's doing a PhD on smart switchable glazing technologies.
Gosh.
So glass that can be transparent or
block out the sunlight
or improve glare conditions so you don't get blinded by the sun in the Mediterranean context. So he's applying that here in Malta and doing research on that.
Yeah. And when you mentioned the bridge earlier on, we didn't say the name of your colleague who...
Stephen Greck.
Stephen Greck. So let's...
Yeah.
Let's
still based in Malta, yes. Yeah.
We'll mention all the people involved in these various projects over the years. So you've done very well. I mean, is there anything lately that you've been awarded or that we could mention?
Lately,
top
I'm
of your CV.
Lately, I find myself getting involved in projects which have around the world, which are more problematic because there's something going wrong with some part of their technology.
I see.
And that ends up being a bit of
a
legal kind of case sometimes, or firefighting, or trying to find solutions to problematic buildings. But one building I remember very fondly was the BBC headquarters in London, where we designed a double skin glass facade, and there's this sculpture on the top of it. If you're kind of in West London, so just at the end of the intersection between Oxford Street and Regent Street, the broadcasting house essentially.
Yes.
And on the top of it, there's this inverted glass cone,
okay,
which is a sculpture. It was built by an artist, and we had to design this kind of glass cylindrical kind of conical kind of sculpture that would be turned on with a big beam of light coming from its bottom every time the BBC news was on.
Oh, okay.
On the BBC One news was on as a kind of a symbol that the BBC is transmitting and feeding knowledge and news to the world, of course, in a BBC sort of way, right?
Yes. How interesting. Now, Malta through international eyes. You visit Malta once, sometimes twice a year, come to see family, your wife as well, of course. The kids say they enjoy it. I remember you wrote a little bit of a scathing article in the Times of Malta. It was published 3 or 4 years ago. When we say scathing, it was very diplomatic. You wrote it, but you wrote about how you felt, and you were reflecting what most of us feel. I mean, it's no secret that construction mania is a bit out of hand. It is said that it's necessary for the economy and whatever, but surely things can be done better. roughly speaking, how do you feel? Do you still feel? Do you stand by that article in the Times of Malta?
Yeah, I think you put it very well. I think it was scathing, but the diplomatic in a way, because I did think long and hard whether I should write it or not, and in the end, I had a chat with my wife, who is my best and most trusted advisor, and she said, "Well, maybe you should because you care." Hmm. Right, so in the end, I thought, okay, I should put pen to paper.
Obviously, you're always when you do that the sort of thing in Malta. Unfortunately, when you write an article like that, you're always risking being tarred. Oh, you're only saying that because you support this party or that party, and I mean, I don't think we should reason that way anymore. And I don't think you were aiming at anyone or any group. Or political group in particular. You were criticizing a problem that's been around for longer than one party's been in government. I think it's something that's been around for... It's always been a problem in Malta, the kind of things you criticized.
Absolutely right. I'm completely apolitical, so I've no affiliation whatsoever.
Indeed.
It's not easy, because as you say, and I'm no economist, of course, but I think the trick is somehow, or the challenge is to maybe decouple the economic prosperity from the construction industry, in the sense that the construction industry can still thrive, but it one is not depending entirely on the other, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think the care for the environment we live in, right, and the built environment is really important.
Mm-hmm.
We live most our lives in buildings and in built up areas, right?
Indeed.
So the quality of that those spaces, the quality of the air, the quality of the, you know, even what you see around you,
mm-hmm.
affects your daily life.
Indeed.
And of course, it's easier to achieve that in a larger country where you can just very quickly drive away from the busy areas, right?
Yes. But
Malta being the size it is, it's very difficult to do that.
Indeed.
So I do not underestimate the challenge and the size of what it's trying to be.
But it was a plea from the heart.
It is. And
you were only pretty much saying what everybody else is. Most other people are saying, apart from those who maybe benefit directly from certain windfalls that might come from over construction.
Yeah.
The article is called "Construction That Works for Malta: Reversing Downward Spiral in Malta's Built Environment Is Essential and Possible," because you gave solutions.
Yeah, indeed. Yes.
So anybody who wants to read this article, it's available online. It was published on the 21st August, 2022. Mauro Overend, "Construction That Works for Malta." But you only wrote that one.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
I did. I was tempted to do a follow-up, but then I thought maybe this is enough and it's for others maybe to...
Take
to follow up on, right?
Indeed.
Essentially, yeah.
Did you see any change?
And I see.
Did anybody listen?
I've seen ideas. I've seen some, and some already around, to be honest. So I think, and I think many people share this idea. I think a country the size of Malta and the density of population of Malta, I don't think there are too many people. I hear many people in Malta, or some people say, "Oh, there's far too many people." Well, there are many urban areas in Europe and other places in the world that are even more densely populated than Malta, and so I don't think too many people is not. I think efficient systems is the for
solution.
Example, an efficient transportation system, mass transportation system, I think is one of the keys to unlocking this puzzle. I think so.
The frustrations
I have lived in London.
Yes,
and there is no way I would be crazy to think that I should drive to the center of London with my car. You would take the rather efficient public transportation system and not even consider taking your car.
Yes, yes. Right?
In the Netherlands, there is a very efficient transportation system, so trams and buses and trains that are all interconnected, of course.
Yes.
But then there's also the bicycle kind of cycling
culture,
infrastructure,
yes,
and
yes.
culture,
infrastructure.
And the infrastructure important,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's massively important.
So that essentially that gives people a genuine choice, and they say, "No, why should I take my car and get stuck in 50 traffic lights? Mm-hmm. I'll take the bike and just bypass everything and get there much quicker."
Mm-hmm.
So when there's that tipping point where a public transportation system becomes more efficient and effective, then I do believe even in Malta you could get people out of their cars and into whatever public transportation system there might be, right? That is more efficient and effective.
Well, that's a perfect kind of comment for this program, Malta Through International Eyes. We're coming to the end, so we'll need to do some a bit of a roundup. So back to a little comment from Anna and Ian, Professor Mauro Overed's children, son and daughter, of course, of Mauro and Natalie, your wife, who couldn't be with us here today. Anna, do you look forward to coming on holiday to Malta when your parents say, oh, we're off to Malta next month? Do you get excited?
Yeah, I feel quite excited because also we don't have a holiday every day. So family is like you
spend need time to together. Yeah,
spend time when you're there with them.
Absolutely. Do you see yourself perhaps when you're older and more independent coming here to visit regularly, maybe even moving here someday?
Visit, yes, I will visit, but living, mm-hmm. probably not, because then I don't think it will be as special anymore.
Ah, that's an interesting point. Yes, absolutely. Do you see yourself living maybe in the Netherlands for the rest of your life, or do you sometimes think, I'd like to try, I don't know, America or UK or Italy or some other countries?
I think maybe the Netherlands, or I would like to try and live in France.
France? Is there something special about France that attracts you?
I think like all the fields and the greenery and like the language I really like.
It is a beautiful country. Absolutely. Ian, I've already asked you about the future. You said the Netherlands. Tell us a bit about, since you're on the verge of starting university, what are your plans for the immediate future?
Immediate future. So I've actually decided to stay at home for the first year of university. And I'll be getting to university via public transportation. So yeah, it's not actually that far.
Will you still play football?
I've been looking into the university football team.
Okay.
So during my introduction week, I'll see how that goes. Have a trial.
Were you ever tempted on trying to take football more seriously? Maybe go turn semi-professional or professional?
I think when I was younger, I mean, I think that was a lot of young children's dreams. Yeah, you ask them what to do, they say professional footballer.
Yes.
It's just how it goes.
Yes.
But I think as I grew older, I found different interests that I took, and I realized I'd rather prioritize those things over putting all my effort into becoming a professional football player.
Professor Mauro Overend, which do you prefer, with all respect, obviously, but if you feel comfortable saying this, but you spent 18 years in Cambridge. Now, how long have you been in The Hague?
In The Hague, six years. Six years in the Netherlands. And 18 years in the UK, 12 of which in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, okay. Yeah. And which has been the best experience overall, including Malta, Cambridge, Holland?
I think it's difficult to say. I think all our... So we spent 3 years in London. That was great. You know, mm-hmm. we before our children were born. And that's a different lifestyle, of course. So that was fantastic, right?
Maybe I'll rephrase. What are the best and less good and worst aspects of living in the three countries that you have lived in?
Yeah. So in the UK, I think the best is that things are very organized. Mm-hmm. There's a system and a process for everything.
Okay.
And therefore, you are not reinventing the wheel every time you need to do some process or procedure, right? So that's a well-organized, very well-organized country. And it's also, I think I enjoy the humor most.
Ah, the British humor.
The British humor I think, unparalleled. So this I mean, it's difficult to pick from this nation, right? Two things. But I think those two things are really the positives. From the Netherlands, I think what I really admire is their... I mean, there's many similarities with the UK, of course, but I admire their pragmatism. So it's getting things done. Mm. And let's not discuss this 50 million times, and let's not have 20 committees to deliberate, but let's start making progress and see where we get to.
Okay.
So things start up pretty quickly in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm.
That is admirable, yes.
So there's this kind of this analogy I think I sometimes refer to, where you've got this hand glider kit. Mm-hmm. And you kind of in a box, of course, and you jump off a cliff and you're building the hand glider as you're going down. And of course, you need to build. So that's of course extreme, right?
Yes, but
in the UK, you would never do that. In the UK, you'd have to have the hand glider built and tested, mm-hmm. tested again, approved by a committee. Yeah. I'm by the dog of that committee. And only then can you take a flight. Where in the Netherlands is a bit more of creative, let's do a few cycles of this before we, you know, mm-hmm. rather than do it once. And so that I enjoy. I like very much.
Negatives?
The negatives, I think both countries, I mean, there. I'm very sorry for our listeners from those two countries, but quite honestly, I think the food and the weather is really something to be...
in both countries. The national food.
Sad about it.
Because nowadays you can get...
The international, yeah.
You can get all sorts of food, but the national food of the countries...
But also the culture of it, right? Okay. But in the Mediterranean, Malta, Italy, Spain, Greece, France, to a large extent, you have this kind of... The food is kind of... A part culture. Of the culture. It's not just, we just have to sustain ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. It's not just a fuel intake, right?
Okay.
it's a lot more than that, right?
I see.
So that of course, is I think, yeah.
We've spoken about the construction problems here in Malta and the lack of a decent transportation system. Yeah. Any other negatives about Malta?
Not particularly. I mean, there are, of course, things that could be better, and we mentioned the transportation, the driving standards, for example, have improved hugely.
Oh, they have. Okay.
I think they have, but of course they're not always
up to top level. Especially the enforcement.
And the enforcement also, yeah. I think maybe the positives I'll say about Malta. Because I think you can read the article about what I think about the negatives. but I think the positives is that I mean, there's some fantastic people with a lot of... Sometimes it can be a negative, right? The passion, right? The fact that you show that you really care, right?
Yes, yes.
Whereas in northern countries, everyone is very often keeps this kind of cool, level-headed kind of way
stiff
of discussing.
Stiff upper lip.
Stiff upper lip. And of course, it's very professional. And but sometimes you need to show, you should show some passion
and some joie de vivre.
That's right. So I think that could if harnessed, that could be a really good thing in Malta, that people care about some things and they show that they care.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And we do have great human resources, among them, that we sometimes export as well, although we could call that a brain drain in some respect, unfortunately. But for example, when you were at Cambridge, there was another Maltese person, I believe, who was a colleague of yours, who was also a lecturer there, I believe.
There were a few. There was a junior research fellow, which sounds rather like a low title, but this is a very prestigious role, and she was an archaeologist there. There was someone else who was working in kind of mathematics also. There's a few very...
We produce some great brains.
There's a few also in the National Health Service, some very well-known surgeons.
Yes,
and so that's... So I think speaking about playing to your strengths, I think Malta has, of course, the weather, the food, the culture, right, and the sea. This, of course, is there. But I think up there with those is the human capital, right? The human resources, right? That's the primary resource.
Indeed.
Right?
Is the and in the Netherlands, I asked this to your kids, but I didn't ask you, the average sort of reaction to the fact that you are from Malta, Willow.
I think I can echo what my children said. So first of all, there's a bit of I've never met a Maltese person. That's a bit of a pleasant surprise.
An icebreaker as well.
Quickly followed by, can you give me some tips because I'd like to go on holiday there? Or can you give me some tips because I'd like to retire there? So there's a genuine willingness to come to Malta, essentially,
that's good.
Which is good. And I find myself trying to, you know, tell them where to go and, you know, what to do and what their interests might be. And of course, when you do that, they're just amazed, right? Because Malta has this such a rich and very long history.
Mm. Yeah, that when it's not just a beach and a beach place.
Absolutely. When they learn about all the, what the hell is that? There were the knights. Oh, there was the great siege. Oh, there were the Neolithic temples.
Because,
of course, when you mention 3,500 BC, most civilizations were pretty much chasing each other with some sticks and stones, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
Our ancestors here in Malta were building these amazing temples, right? So that's something to be proud of.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect way to end this edition of Minai Nein Baranin, Malta Through International Eyes. It's been a great pleasure to have Professor Mauro Overend together with his son Ian and his daughter Anna. It's been great having you on the show. My name is Colin Fitz. This is Campus 103.7. Look up the program on our website. It's called Minai Nein Baranin.